This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
My name is Henry Crossman. I'm 71 years old, a farmer, and I got a beef to pick with my banker. You see, I recently watched a video that showed how my banker is making about 30 times more interest on my money than what they pay me. On my own darn money. And here's the kicker. This is a perk you, me, and almost all regular Americans can take advantage of, too. Here's how it works. Say I put $1,000 in the bank. These bankers then funnel some of the money into a little-known account that earns 5% tax-free. But little guys like us never hear about it. So the net result is they make 5%, we get horse dung in return. That's why I'm taking a stand. I just watched a video where bankershidemoney.com. They talk about how we can grab these higher tax-free returns for ourselves. So do yourself a favor. Write down this address. www.bankershidemoney.com. That's www.bankershidemoney.com. Don't let your banker screw you over.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is...
The Buck Sexton Show.
Who will stand for Ms. Kelly Rindfleisch of Wisconsin? Who is going to take up her cause? Who in the state of Wisconsin, who in the national media, is going to make this the issue that it should be? A prime example, and we talked about Dinesh D'Souza and that egregious miscarriage of justice earlier in the show. But this prosecution of a low-level functionary attached in some capacity or in some communication to the Walker, the Scott Walker campaign. This is politics through prosecution. Very dangerous. This is the kind of stuff that makes other governments illegitimate in our eyes. And as I said, the Obama administration has access to the Wall Street Journal. They know this piece from Colin Levy is out there. Anyone who reads this and does not think we have a really serious problem going on is just closing their eyes and sticking their head in the sand. Because this is politics through prosecution. And it's also another example of just the depths that the progressive left will go to stack the deck in their favor, to tilt the scales towards themselves. This woman, who, by the way, Rindfleisch, ended up pleading guilty to one felony count. And under her guilty plea, the judge sentenced her to 6 months in jail and 3 years probation, which is, of course, completely inconsistent with what other people have been sentenced to. And then they turned it into one big exposition on the possibility of illegal campaign coordination with the Walker campaign. They also decided to release 27,000 pages of Ms. This is on a court order of Ms. Rindfleisch's personal emails at the request of Wisconsin media outlets. Oh, okay, that's great. That tells you which side of this the judiciary stands on. The feeding frenzy of little leftist smarmy piranhas, that is the left-wing media in Wisconsin and across the country, they needed some chum thrown in the water, so the court called for the release of 27,000 pages of Rindfleisch's personal emails. They had nothing to do with anything. This was just meant to embarrass her, because that's another favorite tactic of the Alinskyites. There's so many ways to do it now, so many methods through which to destroy character. And the problem with our current society is that once you are ruined by reputation, you can't restart. This is not the 1920s. You can't hop on a train, switch coasts, and say, oh, okay, well, I'm now Bob Smith and I'm a cobbler. No, there's no new start here. We are all living in this digital panopticon, a prison in which you can be seen at all times by anyone. Anyone can easily see what's happened to you once the government goes after you. And it is in this environment that the government has taken so much power into its own hands. They get you fired for some trumped up malfeasance. They force you to plead guilty. You're marked forever. A convicted felon, you can no longer own a handgun. You can no longer vote. You will have to go through this when you look for housing, when you apply for a job. A felon, a serious criminal. What was her crime again? Oh, that's right. I'm not even going to say that her crime was sending emails inside of a building instead of outside of a building. Her crime was in some way being attached to the campaign of Governor Scott Walker, who went into the progressive heartland of Wisconsin and won victory after victory, and now has won a victory for the people in that he's cutting taxes by $2 billion. The schools are doing just fine. The theories, the promises of an apocalypse if Walker policies went through were seen to be completely ridiculous. And so now it's not just Wisconsin progressives and statists who are upset. It's the progressives and statists across the country. Because if Detroit is the left-wing Democratic model for America, and it is, what about the turnaround that we can see in Wisconsin? What about what's being done in Madison and in Milwaukee by Governor Scott Walker? That's a story of the American people with an economy that has had an anemic recovery, chronic high unemployment, long-term unemployment. That's a story that might have resonance. It might have resonance not just in the media and for our conversations, but it might change who's in control. It might actually switch the levers of power from one set of folks to another. And I have to call out conservatives here. Somebody tweeted at me before, oh, you're calling out conservatives. We do not stand up for each other. Some do, but for the most part, you will notice that when someone who is a favored leftist is attacked in the media, usually for completely justifiable cause, by the way, the mechanisms of the statist left go into overdrive and start attacking everyone who is pointing out whatever that person has done, who is part of the process of exposing them. They go on assault because they recognize that there's power in numbers, there's power in the pack, and they want to keep the statist progressive blog moving along with as many folks as they can. We don't stand up for each other. We seem to believe, in many cases, in law and order, and that the charges have merit. And we think maybe they deserved it, or even worse, and you see this a lot, maybe they're pulling down our side. Maybe they're stained. Maybe now we have to push them off the island before they bring the rest of us conservatives down. Well, you would think that we should at least withhold judgment until we know all the facts. And maybe we should put it in the proper context of our side versus their side. We do not circle the wagons. Leave no man behind. Well, if politics is war, we tend to leave men behind on the political battlefield, and women, obviously, all the time. We let the left eat them up, spit them out, destroy their reputations, and hope that we'll find a better candidate. Oh, maybe we'll find a better candidate. Maybe we'll find somebody who's squeaky clean. Everything's fine. They don't worry about being squeaky clean. They don't worry about what kind of a person they put forward. They worry about whether they can acquire and wield power and what they'll do with that power. Will they advance the cause of the progressive left? Then we're with them. You know, with conservatives, it's, oh, gosh, did you have a DUI? Did you have a messy divorce? Was there somebody in your campaign who was charged with something at some point in time that had to do with our ridiculous campaign finance laws? Then we bail. Then we leave. Then they're on their own. You know, I'll never forget, and I have always taken a personal pride in standing up to bullies, and that's why I'm spending so much of our time today discussing this issue with you, which I think should be leading news broadcasts across the country. Of course, it won't, but this is a political hit. It couldn't be any more clear. It has no place in this country. It's completely unacceptable. It is un-American. It is anti-constitutional. And worst of all, it's immoral. It's vicious. Destroying someone's life without any cause. For a political purpose, mind you. I've always taken a certain pride in standing up to bullies, but I will share with you one brief anecdote. I remember when I was pulled aside with my entire class. I went to an all-boys school here in New York City. And I was, to be honest with you, not fully aware of the situation. I didn't really know what was happening, but I had heard rumors that in a small school with a small class of perhaps 35 or 40 students, one of my fellow students and somebody who was a friend was being severely bullied after school. People were waiting for him after school. And one of the reasons I knew this is because I saw his face once after he had been punched, and it was very clear that they were sending a message. They were from some other part of town. They came over. And I remember a teacher that I had a tremendous amount of respect for. He pulled us all together in a room, and he said, "I don't care what your parents say about this. I don't care what anyone else says about this. That none of you stood for him is unacceptable. He is your brother. No one could walk him home. No one could stand at his side. He was alone to walk home and get beaten up. How many days last week? Who will stand with him?" Now, I didn't really know the facts of the case. I didn't really know who was beating him up. I just knew it had happened. But I hadn't stood for him. Neither had anyone else in the class. That was one of those moments that you remember in your formative years. And you think to yourself, never again. Because once you know, once you have that moment of recognition, that's when you have the formation of character. Do you have it or not? Will you stand for somebody who deserves your protection? Will you help the weak, the oppressed? If you are a conservative, will you stand alongside your brethren when things are tough for them because of their beliefs, mind you? And now this is all beginning to have a certain Christian and Judeo-Christian undertone to it. But perhaps that's on purpose. We leave this woman out to dry. No one raises her case. There's no website claiming that there should be donations for her. There's nothing out there trying to help her. This sets a precedent, but it also says something about all of us if we choose to be silent about it. It is an injustice, and as we know, an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. This is wrong what's happened, just as it's wrong what's happened to Dinesh D'Souza, just as it's wrong what's happened to Mark Widdishek in D.C., who I am hopeful will be joining us shortly here on this program to tell us what it really feels like to get caught in the mandibles of the progressive Leviathan. To really get a sense of what it feels like to be eaten alive by the bureaucrats. I told myself then, when my after we all got brought together, and I will tell you that there was not a single head. We were 13 and 14-year-old boys at the time, and there was not a single head in that room that wasn't hanging down and really thinking about what kind of young men we were becoming, that we left one of our brothers to walk home alone and get beaten up day after day for a whole week. Well, I promise you that after that, he didn't walk home alone, and it's something I never forgot. Do you stand on principle? Do you stand for your brothers and sisters? Think about that while we go into break.
Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network. Buck Sexton.
I just want to give you some of the details on the, maybe we should call it the Walker miracle, although it's not a miracle, it's just common sense and basic principles of limited government put into action. This is from Forbes, Forbes.com piece by, I think it's Travis Brown. Not only has Governor Walker cut taxes to the tune of nearly $2 billion since he was sworn into office in 2011, but he has also reduced the total state burden for all residents of the Badger State. In a state that has seen $2.16 billion in annual adjusted gross income and 65,000 taxpayers flee to other low-income, low-tax states, according to Internal Revenue Service data, Governor Walker recognizes the need to make his state more economically competitive and attractive to businesses while lowering the overall tax burden on Wisconsin's working men and women. The guy is dropping taxes. He's taking power away from the status progressive machine in his state. And guess what? There are benefits to that. The state becomes more economically competitive. It stops losing people to other states like Texas that have decided they want low taxes or even no taxes in some cases. And they want their state to flourish economically. They want an inflow of residents as opposed to an outflow. Billions of dollars going back to the people. Walker's crazy plan is to lower the costs of the state and its operation in Wisconsin such that he can actually give money back to the people. Because it was their money in the first place. This is a fundamental divide between people on the left and people on the right. The left seems to think the Democrats, the umbrella term we use for the leftist, progressive, statist, authoritarians, which is kind of a mouthful. The Democrats are under the impression that the money that you are allowed to keep, you should be grateful for because it really all belongs to the collective anyway. The government lets you keep some of it because the government is so magnanimous. Whereas conservatives think that the government is actually exceeding its mandate, is taking far too much in taxation, is taking far too much in regulatory costs out of the economy, and is a net negative for businesses. It is confiscating at gunpoint, implied force, mind you. Don't pay your taxes long enough and the IRS and men with guns will show up and take away your freedom. And maybe if you're lucky, you'll only have to give them more of your property. Now, this is, I think, an open, when you have a 70,000-page tax code, and we are right in the midst of tax season right now, and when you recognize we have a $1 trillion welfare state in this country, it seems that we could start to ask questions about just under what justification they take from us and threaten us all. And then we begin to sort of have this sense that people get sometimes when they're taken hostage, that any kindness from the hostage takers is just evidence of some sort of benevolence from the inside. Oh, well, they're feeding me. They're not letting me starve, so these must not be bad hostage takers. Well, the IRS, they're not auditing me and ruining my life, so I guess they're not all bad, right? They'll leave me alone. Just please leave me alone, IRS men. I'm so getting audited this year. So that's why this matters so much, though, and that's why when you see the Walker situation playing out now, he's going to have results to pose to the American people as a reason for voting for him. He's going to say, look what I did in my state. Look at the numbers. The numbers don't lie. Look at employment. Employment doesn't lie. That is a mortal threat to the narrative of the other side, which tends to just be a narrative. Look at Barack Obama. I wrote 2 autobiographies. I'm so great. Well, he wrote some of it. I'm so great. Vote for me. I promise you amazing things I can't deliver on. Vote for me. That's what they do. They're the party of espoused fantastic intentions. We promise we're going to give you health care. You're going to have plenty of money and security and everything's going to be great. Just cede all of your rights and don't whine. Just take whatever we give you and everything's going to be great. This is why I call them statist, because they elevate the state to a place of supremacy over the people. That's why it's an accurate term to use for them. It's why I call them authoritarian, because they don't want to be questioned. And in fact, if you try to question the grounds of their authority and its use, they come after you. They want to teach you a lesson. They want you to be silenced, to shut up. They'll find a way to do it. They'll charge you with something, or they'll just destroy your character in the media, which in some ways may be worse. Media character assassination is every bit as damaging in our modern society as politics through prosecution, using the mechanisms of the state, whether it's at the federal, state, or local level, to destroy you that way. There are many, many ways, and Alinsky has written them out. If you want to be familiar with the mindset here, just look at Rules for Radicals. Go back. Alinsky stated all this. Yeah, that Chicago community organizer. Parallel that should be drawn a little more often, I think, now as Obama's walking around talking to the folks. Folks, thank you. Thank you. Folks. This is the new reality we live in. And you can either get enraged about it as I do, or I suppose you can just hope that it'll all go away and everything will be absolutely fine and dandy. Just assume that the statist progressives are going to be gentle with you. Or you can stand up and you can fight. You can decide that they are waging a war on principles, a war on excellence, that they are not your friends, that they need to be stopped, that every election now is a referendum against a trajectory of tyranny. Doesn't mean that Republicans are perfect, doesn't mean that they're doing all these great things. It just means there's a way to say, well, the guy, what you're doing now, the folks in power, I just said folks, somebody smacked me in the face. What you're doing now, what the Democrats are doing now, is not acceptable. Maybe the Republicans will do better. Maybe it's third party. Maybe it's a convention of the states. Maybe it's something, but it's not what's happening now. It can't be what's happening now. Because every indicator is of a society that is losing freedom and that is being increasingly forced to trade freedom for ephemeral, if not non-existent, political benefits. Handouts, goodies, things they're going to give you. There are pieces now that are even asking the question, is Obamacare really a law? This is, again, in the Wall Street. A lot of shout-outs in the Wall Street Journal today, but my three first sources that I always go to, well, I should say my four top sources, this is where I do my first initial scan every morning when I wake up, because I'm a news addict. I go to theblaze.com, then I go to the Wall Street Journal, then I go to Drudge Report, then I go to the New York Times. I know, the gray lady, it's terrible, but I need to know what the other side is thinking. I need to know how they package their arguments. I want to know what Krugman the Keynesian is saying on any given day so that I can fight against it. I want to know how they're packaging Obama's failures so that I can dismantle it and present to you the dismembered pieces of the ridiculous argument that they've made. That's my job, and I like it. But there are pieces now that are asking whether Obamacare can even be considered a law. And I think that's a fair question. It's a fair question because when you've made so many changes to the actual text, what are you resting on? What's the principle at work? We know that today is, in fact, supposed to be our day of final sign-up, but they kind of extended it. They won't say it's an extension. They'll give you a couple of weeks. You're on the honor system. You can't make this stuff up. It's astonishing, isn't it? They think that they can change the law as they see fit, when they see fit, as long as it benefits them politically, which then forces the question at some point, is this even a law? Can you even use the L word? Law. Or is this really something else? It's perhaps a la Jerry Maguire, it's a mission statement. Or was it a memo? Was it a mission statement? It was a mission statement that he wrote. This is the Democrats' mission statement. The socialization of healthcare, the socializing of medicine, under the guise of some free market mechanisms and a whole lot of paper that no one's ever going to read so that they can redistribute wealth. That's really what it is. It's actually just a conceptual document now. So we want to kind of give everybody health care. We want to decide what they get, how they get it, when they get it. And you just need to sit around and accept that that's going to happen now. But what's at stake now is going to be interesting because if there is a switch in power, and in the Halbig versus Sebelius case, you see that the government's position is now the words of the statutes they pass do not mean what they say. And I have to say that I think this is an outgrowth in many ways of the decision to uphold Obamacare in the first place. I have to say this is an outgrowth of the John Roberts travesty that was 5-4, that something could be a tax one day, a penalty another, or just whatever we feel like calling it. No, a tax is not a penalty and a penalty is not a tax. Those are different things. But with that precedent established, now we see that in Halbig versus Sebelius, the government is trying to take a position that the plain language of the law does not mean what it says. This is reminiscent of Animal Farm, one of Orwell's greatest works, although it's along the lines of a children's novel. And so many people think of some of the others. 1984, Homage to Catalonia. There's many. Burmese Days. Many great works by Orwell. but an animal farm. If you recall, the pigs take control of the farm. And one of their favorite things to do, after they've written the laws on the barn door, if I recall, I haven't read Animal Farm in about 15 years. One of their favorite things to do is to just change the laws unilaterally. How is that any different? And that's when you know things get bad. That's when, if you're listening to Animal Farm on tape, the music gets ominous. They change the laws that they themselves write to suit their whims. So you can have no expectation of rights, no expectation of justice. It's merely an extension of politics and of those in power. We are all on the farm, my friends, and the pigs keep changing the laws, and we don't do very much about it at all, do we? That's what we're handling right now. That's what we face. I have a very special guest who's going to take you inside the belly of tyranny in just a minute. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Continue with our discussion of what I think we could call the anatomy of a political hit. The anatomy of a political prosecutorial hit, actually. They've decided to send a message to take somebody out. This has national implications. It has national implications because of what it means for the fight against unions and the progressive left, as seen in Wisconsin, and for the possibility of an actual political candidate, a presidential candidate, who would be quite a threat, it would seem, to the American left. So they go after him right now. They go after his senior aides. I want to get into the politics of this more, but first let's get into the process, the meat grinder aspect of this, the way they are destroying and eroding an individual and her rights. To help me do that, I want to bring in my friend Andrew McCarthy. He is a former federal prosecutor. He was involved in the prosecution of the terrorists from the First World Trade Center bombing. He's also a writer for National Review and an author of Spring Fever, The Illusion of Islamic Democracy, which you can get on Amazon. There's a Kindle edition. Check it out. It is a great read. Andrew, thank you for calling in.
Buck, it's my pleasure. How are you?
Good. So you're familiar with what's going on in these John Doe investigations in Wisconsin. And one thing I have to say I think is kind of amazing for folks listening to all of this is the idea that you could – what they did here was they charged under they charged with a felony – what should have been charged as a misdemeanor, as a means of acquiring cooperation. And then even though she cooperated, they threw the book at her anyway. Andrew, you are a federal prosecutor. Is this ethical to do that in this kind of a case?
No, it's not ethical. And it's something, Buck, unfortunately, that we're seeing more and more. You know, we have this plethora of laws. Justice Scalia, I think it was, spoke it or wrote it one time about Nero posting the laws of the Roman Empire at the top of columns where in small print where they'd be impossible for people to see. And the idea, of course, is that in a tyrannical government, nobody knows what the law is, and therefore the law becomes totally arbitrary. We're having a kind of a modern version of that. We have such a plethora of laws, rules, and regulations that not only can nobody know what the law is, but people in Congress, like the former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, are perfectly comfortable saying you have to pass laws in order to figure out what's in them, so that legislators don't even have to know what's in the laws they write. So why should anyone know what are in the laws that are enacted?
And what we have to add to that, Andrew, what we have to add to that now is that there are clearly instances where the law now, according to the government, does not even mean what it says. In Helbig versus Sebelius, for example,
right,
that when they say the states, they actually mean the federal government, or just in the plain language of the Obamacare statute itself, they can say, well, must do or will do does not mean that. It means if we feel like doing, which is sort of another.
And I think it's a mistake for us to over-lawyer this. Part of the way they intimidate people is they make you think that if you're not a lawyer, you're either not educated enough or clever enough to figure out what it is that they're up to. And of course, the framers never designed us a society that had to be ruled by lawyers. What's going on here is very simple. It's got very little to do with the law as anything but a weapon. And that is, you have Alinskyites who are trained in the use of raw power. And once they acquire the levers of control in government, they can make them do whatever they want them to do, and then they dare you to stop them.
Well, they charge this one, and I completely agree about the Alinskyite tactics, which makes me want to ask you, what redress is there? Is there any way to try to get justice, or at least raise this issue up through the system so that people realize what's happening? They charge this Kelly Rindfleisch, again, a low-level Wisconsin political person, really administrative person. They charged her with four felonies. Now, remember, they charged her with four felonies. The actual only crime that she had committed, even under the statute, was working on government time, and she was using her own devices. She went outside the building. But they charged her anyway with four felonies that could have amounted to 12 and a half years in prison.
Right.
You won't get 12 and a half years in prison in some cases for killing somebody, you know, in a fight on the street.
When I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the last couple of years, we convicted John Gotti Jr. of involvement in the Gambino crime family. I think he got less than 6 years.
Right. For what kind of charges?
Well, you know, running the Gambino family.
Right. So, I mean, I just wanted you to say them. Racketeering, fraud.
We're talking about the things that organized crime families.
Right. 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 Not use of your BlackBerry inside a building when you're supposed to be outside of the building.
Right.
Is there supposed to be some kind of, I would assume there's supposed to be, but is there any efficacy to an ethics committee in the state of Wisconsin for, I mean, this is all happening in the district attorney level, not at the federal prosecutor level, but is there some way that people will review this and say this is a complete abuse of power? It's so overtly political.
What you have to do here, I think these committees and ethics committees where, you know, they investigate for 3 years while the people that they're doing a number on twist in the wind, really end up being counterproductive, because they become part of the grinding process that is the very problem here. The fact that it doesn't matter if you're guilty or innocent, if they bring you into the web of this process, you're basically, you know, you're running through your money, you're running through your time, you're living with anxiety. That's the big problem. So I think what has to happen in these kind of situations is we have to start thinking about impeachment again. I mean, it seems to me that the district attorney here should be impeached.
Absolutely. By the way, on your point about what happened to this woman, Ms. Rindfleisch, and as I said, the only charge she ended up pleading guilty to was using a phone outside or inside a building when she was supposed to be outside under the
right.
strict reading of the law. She liquidated her entire retirement account of $75,000 to pay legal fees. She has not been able. She just got fired from her job again, a new job after getting fired from her legal political job. And she says they did everything they could to financially devastate me. They also they also said that her prosecution, a main portion of the sentence, this is from the judge, was for deterrence. That's a key component, quote, of her sentence. And at her sentencing hearing, one of the prosecutors spent most of his time, this is all again from this Wall Street Journal article, on a 78-page slideshow composed in emails of other allegations of coordination between the county executive's office and the Scott Walker for governor campaign. Andrew, this was all about trying to smear Scott Walker. They annihilated this woman's life and they ruined her because they wanted to make a big show about how there was some cooperation that they couldn't prove with Scott
right.
Walker, who's the governor.
Yeah, and any judge, any decent judge would have said, after the first slide, indict Scott Walker, and if you don't have evidence to indict Scott Walker, let's get on with this woman's case. I think it's unfortunate that that she ended up feeling she had to plead guilty, although obviously her lawyers knew her case better than we do. But I think that's going to end up once you plead guilty, things become much more difficult for you. And of course, she's seeing that now. But this reminds me very much, Buck, of what they did with what the Justice Department did with Dinesh D'Souza. You know, with D'Souza, they took a campaign finance violation that's usually handled by an administrative fine with the Federal Election Commission of a paltry amount of money, $15,000, I think is the allegation, which is, you know, dimensions less than, for example, the Obama campaign's millions of dollars in illegal campaign activity that they allowed the campaign to dispose of with a fine. And they not only charged him with the statute that Congress has for low-level violations of this kind, which is a maximum two-year sentence, they threw in a false statement count in order to basically move the sentence up to 7 years instead of 2 years for the same offense. And it sounds like that's exactly what they did with this woman. They took something that the legislature intended to be a very low-level offense, and they basically charged it under a broader count, and then they added some other felony charges, for good measure, and that ratchets up the pressure on people to plead guilty to things that they're not guilty of because they're worried that it could be even worse if they go to trial.
Right. This is, they racked and stacked and treated her like an axe murderer by putting all these things together with the hope that they did get a guilty sentence. They're also trying her now again for something else. Andrew, have you ever in your career, both as a federal prosecutor and now as a writer, as an author who looks at these issues, is this an unprecedented weaponization of the law, of the bureaucracy that enforces the law, law enforcement agencies, under the Obama administration? Have you ever seen anything like this before?
No. I think what we're seeing is exactly what we began talking about, which is that you have movement leftists, movement progressives who get into power, and they understand, because power is what they're about, that it's the process that penalizes people. And they can visit this process on whoever they choose to visit it on, so that we're back to the old Stalinist saw that, show me the man and I'll find you the crime. That's exactly what their approach is.
That's absolutely astonishing. Andrew, your latest book is Spring Fever, correct? The Illusion of Islamic
Democracy. That's right, yeah.
Spring Fever, Illusion of Islamic Democracy. You guys should check that out on Amazon. There's a Kindle edition out. Andrew McCarthy from National Review, thank you very much for joining. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, Buck.
All right. Guys, more details on this and the politics behind it, which might be the single most essential aspect to understand when we come back. The call-in number is 888-900-3393. Buck Sexton, The Buck, will be back in just a minute.
Let your voice be heard.
Hello.
888-900-3393.
Buck Sexton Show.
On the Blaze Radio Network.
Sexton Show, 888-900-3393.
Give me a ring. Let me know what you think about this. Again, I can't overstate what a violation of principles this is, what a grotesque injustice it is, and on top of that, the implications for our next president, I think, are very clear, could be very clear, depending on how all of this shakes out. This is how they do business now. This is how, as my last guest, Andrew, said, the Alinskyite left does its business. They will destroy you. They will ruin you. They don't care about the collateral damage, the constitutional damage. They could care less about that. I just have a few more details and thoughts on this. But before I get to that, I did want to bring in one of our regular callers here, Jason from D.C. Thank you for calling in, buddy. Thank you for holding. What's up?
Hey, Buck. How you doing?
Good.
I just didn't know if most of the listeners who have been following what's been going on in Turkey. But, the prime minister over there a few days ago tried to shut down Twitter and YouTube, because what's happened is there's an audio clip out there that was taken during a state meeting where they talked about performing a false flag attack on their own assets so that they could be drawn into or have a legitimate excuse in the eyes of the public to be drawn into the Syrian conflict. Now, this isn't getting as much play as it should. I have no idea why. Unless, of course, you start to think about, how when we were going to have a vote on Syria, how Republicans and Democrats were split down the middle in a lot of cases, where both Republicans and Democrats, like the Lindsey Grahams, the John McCains, the Barack Obamas, the John Kerrys, the Hillary Clintons, the Harry Reids, were all on the same side of military interventionism policies, that they don't want this to be out there.
So you think that, just give me the one-sentence summation here of what you think is going on. You think that there is a false flag operation at play?
Well, what had happened was there was they have been talking in Turkey during this government meeting about staging a false flag incident in order to give them justification. Now, the key to it is in the dialogue that was going on from the transcribed recording, the Turkish officials are talking about how John Kerry is pushing Turkey into doing something with Syria. So somehow our administration is pushing for war in Syria, but they want to have an excuse for this to take place. Now, whether Kerry knows it's going to be a false flag or not, or what the tools will be, the fact is the U.S. is putting pressure on Turkey to get involved in Syria, and now Syria is looking for excuses, not legitimate things, but they're trying to concoct a reason to get involved in this conflict.
Hmm. All right.
Now, the scary part is Turkey is part of NATO. Well, how do you know that something doesn't get cooked up so that it's that we have to say, well, one of our allies is being attacked by Syria. Now we have justification for attacking the country when the American public is completely against this in every way, shape, or form.
Jason, you're going to give me heartburn. It's too early on a Monday for this kind of talk. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, this is the hard part. You know, that's the scary part about a lot of this stuff that's going on behind the scenes. None of this has any sort of constitutional authority. It is just reeks of corruption. And again, it highlights what states do. States use their power to control things like the newspaper, the radio, the television, and now the biggest thing in the last few years is the internet, because they're afraid that the public can be exposed to how corrupt they really are and what they're really doing behind the scenes, for purposes of not legitimate national security, but for pure manipulation.
Well, this is the one thing that came out of the WikiLeaks cables, it seems, is that some of these Arab states were so appalled at the level, the depth, and the brazenness of the corruption, of particularly regimes like the Ben Ali regime in Tunisia, which we don't really hear, is not as familiar to us as Gaddafi is, for example. But they just couldn't stomach it anymore. They couldn't stomach being in these downtrodden societies with no options for the young, and have these people who are figuring out how many white tigers they want to put in their backyard, or how many private jets they're going to buy for their shopping sprees back and forth to London, while their people are essentially living in a state of despair, and if not dire poverty, then near dire poverty. And it was too much. So, yeah, governments are increasingly going to want to exert control over the web. And one thing we're seeing, I think, now as well, especially with the recent ICAM decision, is that there's going to be a balkanization of the web that occurs, and there'll be different controllers and regional controllers of how the web functions. You know, China already obviously has its great firewall, but there are other countries that I think are working on similar things, because controlling the perception and controlling the web is controlling the people, and that's what they want to do.
Yeah, and the scary thing is we would joke about the same thing 20-something years ago about East Germany and Stasi this and so forth. But we have morphed our own place into exactly what the Church Commission hearings in the 1970s warned us about. We have got a surveillance, quasi-surveillance state. And the problem is, look, it's not a problem if we go through the court system and there's a legitimate function of going through, you know, a warrant for when we get into these abuse cases. But now it's just blanket everything. I mean, the other day, the state of California said that they're reading every license plate that's out there that they can get their hands on.
Well, you know, Jason, I tell people about, for example, this case in Wisconsin, which I think, and I'm going to make the case shortly about how it has ramifications well beyond. I mean, there are things about Wisconsin that could affect the rest of the country. And of course, there's the looming presidential election as well for Walker. But it's the idea that in our modern America, we should be thinking that more power in the hands of bureaucrats is a good thing because we can trust them. What this shows, and this is why I like to scream this sort of thing from the rooftops, is that that is a terrible idea. That's actually inviting tyranny. At least in some societies, tyranny comes at the end of muskets or guns or swords or whatever the armament of the day is. Here, we're almost inviting it. We're saying, yeah, sure, you can be in charge of everything. We trust you. Go ahead. You can know everything. That's fine. Doesn't worry me. Yeah, I trust you guys to make the right call about whatever the law is, whatever Obamacare is, whatever the Bill of Rights actually says. We are being lulled into this sense of false security by them all the time.
Yeah, and it's a bizarre world sort of situation where the person that wants to open up a donut shop is probably under more type of control by the government than those that are in positions of power that actually decide the true scope of life and death of what takes place in our society.
I don't know. I actually get outraged, and I think back to the Founding Fathers and the Stamp Act and the Boston Tea Party, and I get annoyed as I sit at a desk and try to print out all these forms and make sure I have the right stuff and trying to figure out taxes and talking to a tax expert and all this stuff I have. This is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. Yeah, because of morons like Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, and many, many others who think they should be telling me, you know, what I pay, how I pay it. It's all just giveaways to their constituencies and part of the huge welfare state we have. I shouldn't have to go through all of this. This is ridiculous.
But remember, Buck, it's always for your own good because you're too stupid to figure this stuff out on your own. And you need to have somebody from an Ivy League school that knows what your heart and desires are for liberty to dictate where you're going to be moving through life.
That's how they approach it. That is a summation of their perspective on this stuff. Jason from D.C., the one and only, a frequent caller into the program, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. We got a little diverted there into some national security stuff, but it still ties into the overall status narrative that we're handling here. Make no mistake about it, though, and I want to give you a little more on the politics of this and the corruption that is at work here in this Kelly Rindfleisch case. Do you think the Obama administration doesn't get the Wall Street Journal? Do you think they have no access to what's going on out there? They're not aware of what's happening to the Walker campaign. You'd have to be completely out of touch with the universe to think that that somehow is not the case, that they can't figure out what's going on here. What they're really telling you, though, is that your freedom is at their whim and the Constitution is no protection for you anymore. But the question that I ask is, who stands up for the weak? Who stands up for the truth? Who is, in fact, the one in government here, or who has enough power in the public discourse to show some humility and humanity and step in and do something about this? Nobody will do that, it seems. Kelly Rindfleisch, whom I've never met, I know nothing about her other than what I have read here, seems she's on her own. And I have to say, this is one place where I begin to get agitated with conservatives, agitated with Republicans, annoyed in general at the inaction that so many seem to think is an okay place for them to be. No one will do anything for this woman. No one seems to care about the fact that she is the victim of a witch hunt in the furtherance of a political agenda that could affect you in your home state. Conservatives are not good at circling the wagons. You will notice this. We do not stand together on many issues. I understand it's more difficult for us because, unlike the other side, we actually try to hold to and adhere to some principles, and they do not. They have no principles to defend. That's a much easier place from which to operate. But this is why on the Chris Christie issue with the bridge, I went on Real News right away and I said, can we just wait before we let the media light the torches and get the pitchforks and claim that this is the end of a presidency? And right away, it became nonstop. It was getting more coverage on MSNBC than the O.J. Simpson trial was getting back in the 90s, when I still remember seeing that on every TV across the country on almost every channel for months. MSNBC was treating the Chris Christie bridge situation like it was the invasion of Normandy or something. I mean, it was absolutely astounding how dogged they were in their coverage of such a non-issue. And even if you want to say it's an issue, the truth is they weren't willing to wait until the facts came out at all. I mean, they're not journalists, though. I mean, they're a hack outfit of left-wing partisans that will do the Obama administration's bidding. And as long as the ratings are okay, they'll keep going. But make no mistake about it. This, what we see in Wisconsin, this is what we are up against now. Oh, sure, yeah, President Obama, he will go on comedy shows. It's all fun and games. And Michelle loves America's children, doesn't want them to be too chubby. And we're all ultimately supposed to be on the same team. If we were supposed to be on the same team, somebody would see what's going on in Wisconsin, somebody in a position of power, and they would call it out. They would call a stop to it. Somebody would say, this is unacceptable. We can't go on this way. But there's a much bigger issue here. Did you know that... In Wisconsin right now, Walker has cut taxes to the tune of nearly $2 billion since he was sworn into office. He's also reduced the total tax burden for all residents of the state. Oh my gosh, it's working. We can't let anybody know about that. More in a minute.
Buck Sexton
on the Blaze Radio Network.
What if 9/11, the economic collapse, the words and actions of American leaders are actually part of an ancient mystery? A mystery so precise it foretells actual events and gives exact dates. A mystery behind everything, even your bank account. What does the future hold for America and for you? See for yourself in The Harbinger Decoded. Watch as best-selling author Jonathan Cahn uncovers and decodes the mysteries based on one of the longest-running New York Times bestsellers, The Harbinger Decoded. Available everywhere.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is
3, 2, 1. The Buck Sexton Show.
Well, it was pretty much expected, I think, that the Obama administration would make some kind of effort, some kind of attempt at a Mideast peace process. This is something that I've mentioned to you before on the show, and this is something that is of interest to me just because it's really all about the glory and legacy of Obama and John Kerry at this point. It has very little to do with U.S. national security or strategic interests abroad. I just want to give you a little taste, a little update of what we're seeing in this Mideast peace push. And I guess it's something that we should keep an eye on. And perhaps we could consider this to be a Buck Brief.
You are entering the Blaze Threat Ops Center. This is a secure space. All outside comms are down. Prepare to receive the Buck Brief.
So Washington said Friday, this is from AFP, as posted on Yahoo News, it was reviewing its push for a Middle East peace process agreement as a spiral of tit-for-tat moves by Israel and the Palestinians took hard-won talks close to collapse. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who has invested more than a year of intensive shuttle diplomacy in the talk process, said there were limits to the time Washington could devote to it. This is not open-ended, Kerry said during a visit to Morocco, adding that it was a reality check time and he would evaluate with President Obama what Washington does next. There are limits to the amount of time and effort the United States can spend if the parties themselves are unwilling to take constructive steps. A peace process that is over before it seems it even began. Only this administration could manage such feats of sheer brilliance. Just amazing on the world stage. But I have to put a pin in this for a second because we wanted to have our friend from National Review, Charles Cook, weigh in. We had a little bit of a tech issue with the phones, but that has been resolved. And therefore, I bring to you now the one and only Charles Cook. Thank you, sir, for calling back in.
Thank you for having me.
So we're going to backtrack a little because I wanted your take. I really thought the piece, the editorial written by the editors of National Review this morning on the Mozilla firing hit all the right notes and really laid out what the case is against this kind of activity. What do you have to say about it, Charles? I just want to hand you the floor.
Well, I've just been writing a little thing myself, actually, on this. It is the mob getting its own way against the private conscience of an individual. And I think you said earlier, this is not the public professions. This is not the CEO using the Mozilla brand, not the CEO using Mozilla's money. This was 2008. He made a private donation, which I think was leaked by the IRS, said in First Things. Anyhow, the reality here is this. The left has just about crawled over the point at which they're winning on gay marriage, just an inch over the line. There's just about a majority that agrees with them. They've just got a few Supreme Court decisions that went their way. They do seem to be about to fall like dominoes. And I'm a proponent of gay marriage myself, but that's always been slightly tempered by the worry that what would start off as a call for freedom would be very quickly transmuted into a call for orthodoxy. And in there, just about stronger than the opposition position, they've started to crush their opponents. You don't want to take photographs of a gay wedding. You're a bigot. That's illegal, unconstitutional even in New Mexico. You don't want to bake a cake for a gay wedding. You're a bigot. That's illegal. Any attempts in Arizona to restore property rights so that people can follow the dictates of their consciences in their own stores was met with charges of anti-gay, anti-homosexual bigotry, and Jim Crow. And now we see a man who had no intention whatsoever of moving his privately held views into the public sphere. None. Not a single one.
And why is it that, I mean, you're seeing now...
And yet
go ahead, Charles.
He's been pushed out. Sorry, and yet he's been pushed out. This is a man who made it very clear when he was appointed that all he wanted was to facilitate diversity, allow everybody to work where they wanted to, and he was going to work with, he wrote literally LGBT people to do that. And yet because he has his own private views, he's deemed unacceptable, and the lynch mob came in.
How do you think that there can be any, again, this was pointed out in National Review, and it's something that came to me as soon as I read about this last night, which is that not only are they going after an individual for his private beliefs outside of even his, he works for a private company, but even outside of his professional function, this is just a guy who was supporting something on his own time. And this is sort of the equivalent. It seems the left has always had this this complete apoplectic fit whenever the issue of, oh, well, are anti-war protesters being surveilled and then punished afterwards, or are people being punished for their free speech rights? It seems here that there is this sense that they weren't so much opposed to what they call the fascistic tendencies of the right to oppose them. They actually just, on principle, they actually just wanted that power for themselves, which is a very dangerous turnabout.
Yeah.
And when you see President Obama in 2008 saying essentially the same thing that this guy was supporting, and he's a public figure, he's running for Senate, and that's forgiven. Why is that forgiven?
No, I must correct you there. Barack Obama said an awful lot more than this guy. This guy gave $1,000 to Proposition 8. He hasn't said much about it. Barack Obama not only said that he thought the marriage was between a man and a woman explicitly on television in front of everybody, but he said that he thought that because his religion dictated it and therefore would be upholding it.
I just mean they're supporting the same, they were on the same side of this issue.
I agree with you, but yeah. I think it's worth saying that President Obama was a lot more explicit, and yet he was given a pass at the time, and he's certainly given a pass now. You're absolutely right when you say they just wanted the power. The left doesn't want private businesses to be free to do as they please. It's pretending it does today. The left wants private businesses to be free to do what the left wants them to do. Now, if you look at the petitions that were signed, and you look at this one guy who runs this gossip blog in the Valley, Silicon Valley, the basic position of Ike's critics is that he needs to repent in public, almost as if it were an inquisition. He needs to admit that he was wrong, that his reasoning was wrong. He needs to apologize for having been wrong. And then he needs to donate his money to a group that is diametrically opposed to the positions held by Proposition 8 and its backers. This is really no different than the Spanish Inquisition in structure. It is torquemada, I think you said earlier, and that's precisely how they behaved. Now, they won't torture him, but it was made very clear in the articles that were written against him, and indeed in this petition that got 75,000 signatures, that if he refused to do any of those things, he should be removed by Mozilla, or he should resign. They do not want anybody working there who disagrees with them. And I would ask the question, I don't know how many people who disagree with this decision are listening to your show, but what exactly, if you are listening, did you think was going to happen if he stayed in place? He'd made very clear how he'd run the place.
Right. There was no threat. There was no reasonable expectation that this guy was. And in fact, by all accounts, the company he works for is incredibly inclusive and tolerant. And but you get the sense that it's not enough to have a CEO who is hiring gay people without any regard to whether they're, I mean, I don't know if now they're considered a protected class where you have to, sort of the way there is affirmative action in government hiring, you have to have a certain number of minorities. I don't know if now companies are explicitly, openly hiring people who are gay as a means of diversifying. I believe that that actually, I know that's happening in colleges. I believe it happens at some companies as well. But he's hiring people. He's certainly not excluding anyone. And yet it seems like unless he's willing to be the minister at a gay wedding personally, it's unacceptable. That's the impression that you get from all of this.
Look, let's run a thought experiment here. Mozilla seems to pride itself inexplicably on being the most tolerant company in the world. You look at their press releases, having got rid of the guy, they said we did it because we're tolerant and we want everyone to be welcome. But it does seem to see itself as being particularly diverse or whatever other buzzwords you wish to throw at it. But pretty much every corporation hews to the same line. It's not as if Coca-Cola says we're not tolerant, we're not diverse. It's not as if McDonald's is going to come out and say, well, they're very tolerant, but we're 80% of that. Whatever progressive corporate speak you get now in the prospectuses for Fortune 500 companies and large corporations, they're all pretty much interchangeable. Now, are we to start reviewing the campaign contributions and previous statements of all of the country's managers and CEOs? Because if we are, then American capitalism will collapse tomorrow. It's a pretty big, diverse, differently thinking sort of country.
Well, you also
I don't know why this should stop. If it's not good enough for Mozilla, then why is it good enough, say, for a Coca-Cola or a McDonald's or a Walmart? Why not demand that everybody at Hobby Lobby resign?
Well, that's I think that what they hope here is they find, this is very Alinskyite, right? You find your target, you freeze it, you isolate it, you separate it from the rest, and then, of course, it's an example. So you don't have to do this to everyone to get the effect you want, which is essentially to say that if you don't go along with us, you're somebody who is outside the mainstream and you are subject to possibly this kind of treatment. I mean, people always talk about the First Amendment and the chilling effect of government. Forget about the chilling effect of government for a second. Imagine this. Any person who applies for any job anywhere could find themselves a target of, as I like to call them, the social media assassins or the Twitter lynch mob. And then all of a sudden it just becomes a pressure campaign to get someone fired. Very few people have so much clout in their job that if there's a clamor to get them fired for bigotry or racism or whatever, no matter how manufactured, they'll be able to weather that. This is a really dangerous circumstance, a really dangerous paradigm that's been set up.
Yes. And when I talk about the disaster now that are the British free speech laws, my main criticism is that they are inherently subjective. They give a heckler's veto to anyone who wishes to use it. And that heckler, that veto can then say, well, I was hurt. Well, I'm offended. Well, I am upset. To which the correct response, of course, is so what? But very often, and certainly under law in England, it's not. Now, in this case, the only answer to the question I posed earlier, what did you think was going to happen, is I thought that I was going to have to work in a company in which the CEO disagreed with me. That's it. Nobody seriously thought that they were going to be fired or treated badly or shouted at.
No, in fact, the law
is going to be docked.
The law does protect people from being discriminated against because of sexual orientation.
Right.
It does not, however, apparently protect you for saying that you think that traditional marriage is preferable for America. That is not protected.
Right. But that is therefore instilling in the corporate culture a precedent. Not a legal precedent, it should be said. This is not a First Amendment issue. But a precedent in which if the employees of a company feel uncomfortable because somebody has a different political or moral or ethical or religious view than they do, then they can say that they can't reconcile that company's mission with this individual and try to get them fired. That's not a healthy culture, I'm afraid.
No, it's not a healthy culture at all. Well, Charles, when is your piece on this going to be up?
This afternoon,
you can see Charles Cook's latest on this Mozilla firing. I recommend you go check it out at nationalreview.com. Charles Cook, as always, my friend, thank you for joining. Thanks for your patience today getting you on the phone. We'll have you on again soon.
Talk to you soon, bye.
We are going to have a continuation of the Buck Brief, assuming that I can get my other guests on the phone here. Another surprise for you in just a minute. Don't go anywhere.
Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network. Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
So when I say Buck Wild Freestyle, apparently I mean it, because the conspirators of the shadowy Soros underworld sometimes do things like mess up our phone lines. And then guests that we have scheduled for earlier in the show have to call in later in the show. And then all of a sudden it just gets crazy in here. And I've got Scott running the board, and I've got Brian running the phones, and we're all running around like maniacs in the break. And oh my gosh, it is indeed dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria. That happens here sometimes on Fridays. With that in mind, now I want to bring you another esteemed and illustrious guest, one of my favorites on national security, for a continuation of that Mideast talk we were doing in the Buck Brief. We now have Jim Carafano. He's a PhD. He's also a senior scholar. Thank you very much for calling in, Mr. Carafano. Good to hear from you. Heritage Foundation. Thank you.
It is good to be with you, my friend.
So I'm trying to sort of find a way to explain to folks just how much of a faceplant it seems to me that the John Kerry efforts so far at Mideast peace process, this is kind of like doing a cannonball if you're a little on the heavier side and splashing water on everybody. Nobody's impressed, everybody's annoyed, and it was kind of a waste. What do you say?
John's working with me. He really is. I wrote a piece in National Interest way back when, said, this guy's not going to last the term and he's going to get fired. And that was after the Syria debacle, because if you remember correctly, President Obama had nothing. He didn't want to do anything with Syria. John Kerry was the guy who said, oh, we got to have a peace conference. We've got to have a peace conference, and we need a red line. So the president put both those on the table because he fully expected that none of them would happen. He wouldn't have to do anything. And then, of course, the red line got crossed. He went to Congress. Congress wasn't going to let him do anything. And I think Kerry would have gotten fired, except, you know, the Russians said, let's have a conference, and he didn't. What Kerry has been doing in the Middle East peace process with the Israelis and Palestinians, this is the foreign policy equivalent of the house is burning down and John Kerry is in the kitchen ironing the linens.
Oh, gosh. I mean, that's not good.
Not only is it irrelevant, but it wasn't going to happen. There was no way it's going to happen. The man's made 11 trips. He's flown over there 11 times to confer with these people. And the entire world knows that this is meaningless. And it wouldn't be so bad if there was nothing going on in the Middle East. But if you've got 10 seconds, let's just look at this. Iran, you know, Iran is more dangerous than ever. The Russians are more empowered than ever. They're going to side with the Iranians. Syria is a disaster. The only people left in Syria are Iraqis that fled to Syria to escape the war, because everybody in Syria has fled to either Lebanon, Kurdistan, or Jordan. Jordan's on the brink of collapse because they're so overwhelmed with refugees. Saudi Arabia is burning all the American flags now. Iraq is more dangerous than it's ever been, and they're about to have an election which may cause a civil war. Egypt is on the brink of, we don't know, we're going to have the next Mubarak or the next Arab Spring.
Right, but none of that stuff gets you an automatic Nobel Peace Prize if you just get close to the goal line, right? So this really comes down to the greater glory of the Obama administration and John Kerry, windsurfer extraordinaire.
It's unbelievable. It's like our interests, and look, people say, well, what do we care about the Middle East for? First of all, we're cranking out our own oil and gas right and left, right? And our troops are home. Why do we care? First of all, because oil is a global commodity. And if the Middle East oil goes off the market, that's going to create a global crisis, which we don't need. And the other thing is last time I checked, geography matters. And the Middle East is called the Middle East for a reason. It's because it's in the middle of everything. So financial sector, logistics, oil, they all transit through this region. A regional war in the Middle East is an utter catastrophe, and at least one country in the Middle East has nuclear weapons. So the notion is we don't have to care about the Middle East. I'm not saying we need boots on the ground. I'm not saying that, you know, we need to be occupying countries. I'm just saying is if you think the Middle East is not important to us, then explain to me, since why really kind of almost since the American Revolution, the United States has had things we've had to worry about in the Middle East or North Africa. So it's nuts to say we shouldn't care about this. And when you have the Secretary of State literally, you know, going out on field trips while war is raging around him, it's kind of a stunt.
Yeah, I like the Walter Russell Mead line from he's at the Council on Foreign Relations for the folks listening. Walter's line on this is, you know, essentially this is boiled down, but you may not want us to be involved in the Middle East, but the Middle East is involved with us. There's really no way to completely.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty accurate. And you know what the reality is, and what's really interesting is not only is the Middle East in crisis, but it's not even the Arab Spring. Everything is worse off than when President Obama took office. And the one thing, regardless of what you thought about Bush and invading Iraq and whatever, the one thing that we had going for us is at a point in time there, we had good relations with the Turks, the Israelis, the Jordanians, and the Iraqis. And what that gave you was a band of states that were not Shia, spanned across the Middle East, and offered a firebreak against the Shia-Sunni civil war, a firebreak against Iranian expansion, and an opportunity to really drive Middle East policy. And over the course of Obama's presidency, he has tossed them out the window one by one.
That's really been amazing. I should say amazing because actually I think there was an expectation that they would try. I knew they would try this. I've actually said it before. They're going to make some lunge at Middle East peace because that's what great administrations
right.
do. And of course, they all end up failing. And if they were serious, they would look at, as you've pointed out, some of these flashpoints that are going completely out of control right now and trying to do something worthwhile there. Instead, they want to go try to make some sort of let's make a deal situation between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Like that hasn't been tried before. But on Ukraine, if I could, because that's sort of fallen out after it was, you know, the number one sort of news cycle story until the plane, obviously. But Ukraine is still continuing to be a place where there's some real concerns. You got Putin with his troops on the eastern border still, as I understand it. They're still there. And if that's changed, someone let me know. And now they've pulled out their ambassador, as I understand it. The Russians are basically saying, look, you know, we can play this game, too. We're not backing down one bit. And they're also now, you know, just basically saying that we're going to jack up the price of natural gas to Ukraine and it's ours. Is this thing over? Are we never really going to hear about this anymore for a while? And it just sort of gets Putinized. I like that. Putinized.
Well, here's the deal is Putin going to invade? Is Putin not? People are asking all the wrong questions. What Putin has done is he's created a situation where he is driving the train and he has options. I mean, he must have loved, because if you scroll down Google News or whatever, hundreds of stories about will the Russians invade, how many troops are there. So basically, everybody is afraid of this. Well, that's good to know. So with tens of thousands of troops there, he has options. He can invade. He cannot invade. He could trade. But look at how he's moved the goalposts. The president said, we want diplomacy. But when the president said, we want diplomacy, what we really want is for the Russians to leave the Crimea, and let's just talk about this. And then what Putin did was totally move the goal line, right? So now we're not going to debate about the Crimea at all. What we're going to talk about now is what else am I going to do to get away with? So he is definitely in the driver's seat here. And when, you know, for President Obama to come out and make a statement like he did in The Hague, like Putin is doing this out of weakness, you know.
Why do people keep saying this? It's so blatantly ridiculous to say that his moves, he's gotten everything he's wanted. This is like someone saying, you know, if I went into a store and walked out with my arms full of stuff, well, you know, you didn't get anything. No, actually, I got everything I could carry. He got everything he could carry.
Well, you know, it's kind of like the rich guy and somebody breaks into your house, and the guy that breaks into your house has a third grade education and $10 in his pocket. He goes, "Well, you're robbing me out of weakness." Well, really? Okay, but dude, what does it matter? I'm robbing you. Okay, so yeah, if we look and say Russian population is aging, half of them are alcoholics. I mean, this is a country that's going to be in decline.
Right, they've got a demographic time bomb, the whole thing, yeah.
Okay, great. All that may be true, but that doesn't solve the problem that they're screwing with you right now and getting away with stuff. And the other thing is always like Really, is that your point, that countries that operate out of weakness should be pitied? Because, you know, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor because they were afraid of American power. Germany
right. Yeah, people in corners do very dangerous things, too.
Yeah, they're actually sometimes more dangerous than – so, I mean, you just absolutely stand here and your jaw just slaps on the ground. So here's my one prediction that you heard it here first on the Buck.
Let's go. I'm hearing it, yeah.
Look, 2016, everybody's going to be running against Obama's foreign policy. Even if Joe Biden is a Democratic candidate, he's going to be running against Obama's foreign policy. Nobody is going to say four more years of this.
You heard it here first, everybody. James Carafano of the Heritage Foundation. James, your Wiki at War book, is that available on Amazon?
It is, yeah, and it's in paperback. And it's even an audio book, which if you want to listen to 14 hours of me, good luck. But
there we go. Wiki at War, Conflict in a Socially Networked World, James Carafano's latest. Follow him at JJ Carafano on Twitter. James, thank you very much for calling in. Good talking to you, buddy. Guys, that was the Buck Brief for today. We're going to be back with more Buck Wild Freestyle in just a minute.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network. The Buck Sexton Show.
It is indeed, and a big part of the show is hearing from all the folks listening. We affectionately refer to each other as Team Buck. And with that in mind, I tell you the call-in number is 888-900-3393. And we have Jason, one of our regulars, on the line right now. We'll take his call. Jason, thanks for waiting, buddy. What's going on?
Hey, Buck, in an empire of lies, I guess telling the truth is treason.
That's right. In a time of universal deceit, speaking the truth is a revolutionary act. Orwell, bam, yeah. Drop the mic.
Yeah, pretty scary stuff. I mean, you know, the thing that really gets to me is how what happens is the politicians in place today, when the public opinion starts to change towards something that they can capitalize on, they sort of rebrand it as if they've always been along with this. So when you have a Pelosi and a boxer, guess what? They knew everything that was going on. Everything. Okay, for them to pretend that they did not know what was going on, that is a statement of shock.
Well, I do want to be fair, though, Jason, because I said this once on the Saturday show. I had a very dear friend, a colleague from inside the national security complex, shall we call it, and he actually briefed Pelosi a number of times personally, and he once told me that, you know, she has the cold, dead eyes of a goat and the intellect to match. So it's not all her fault, I would think. I mean, she's actually just out of her depth, despite the fact that her husband's worth $50 million. But I cede the floor back to you, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, and the scary part about it is that they sell, you know, the candidates like soap, whereby we never really understand where they stand, and they're always double talking with their ways. Like, my guess, the best example of this would be the Amash Amendment that took place. Basically expose those on the left and those on the right that in their hearts are truly authoritarian, that think they know what's better for everybody and will lie and cheat to do it, from my perspective. That was a wide-opening moment for us. So the Reeds, the Pelosis, the Boxers, the Obamas, the Clintons, the Kerrys, McCain, Grahams, and McConnells. Guess what? They were all for bombing Syria, which we just found out from an MIT report. Okay, there was no way the missiles could have come from the Assad regime. Okay, total and complete fraud. We could have been at war with this.
Let's just cycle back a little bit here. Details, what are you talking about?
All right, the MIT, there was a report by a former UN inspector, Richard Lloyd. He put out a report that basically determined that the sarin gas that was used, that we were going to use as justification, it didn't match any of the patterns that the Assad regime had. Additionally, the missiles that were used, the range of them could have never come from the territory where the Assad regime was operating. It could have only come from rebel groups having possession of the gas.
Hmm. Do me a favor, Jason. I would love to. I haven't done a really deep dive on Syria in some time. Talk to our producers here. Send me everything you got on this because I want to dive into it tonight. Because I want to be able to talk. I mean, you're talking about a false flag that could have brought us into a war, essentially. That's what you're saying.
Absolutely. And what's happened is, remember, in the last week, what we've had is, remember, the government of Turkey wanted to shut down Twitter and YouTube. And all of the major media outlets just said they did not tell you why they wanted to shut it down. And the answer is the governments want to control the internet because the internet allows the individual now to check on their governments and see what's going on. And they're afraid of it. So that's why they want kill switches and stuff. It has nothing to do with terrorist internet attacks.
Yeah, it's to control the message.
Absolutely. So what happened was in this latest revelation that came out in the leaked audio tapes of them talking to what happens is
Soros.
They mention the words like, this is a quote, "I'll send four men from Syria if that's what it takes. I'll make up a war by ordering a missile attack on Turkey. We can also prepare an attack on the Somalan Shah tomb if necessary. Don't worry, we'll portray this as Al-Qaeda. There's no distress if it's a matter regarding Al-Qaeda. And if it comes to regarding us defending the Shamallah tomb, it's just a matter of us protecting our land."
Huh.
Now remember, Turkey's part of NATO. Article 5, an attack on one is an attack on all. Now the U.S., guess what? We can get involved because you attacked the Turks. Nobody's sitting there questioning the fact that Turkey has been funding a lot of the arms and stuff through their country.
Yeah, well, Turkey's allowing the rear guard areas, essentially, of the conflict to be on its own soil. They say that's for just, you know, not for humanitarian purposes. But let me tell you, I've been in the Zaatari refugee camp. I want to go to the Turkish refugee camps. There's plenty of recruitment going on there and funding and all kinds of training and stuff. So that's what's actually happening.
So the hard part is, and the scary part for us is the fact that, you know, the American public is led around like, you know, like a bull with a ring through its nose through the propaganda words that they use: fear, patriot, fair, you know, whatever it may be for the buzzword of the situation that they can use to manipulate public support. And if you think somehow the public is wise to this, we're controlled just like somebody buying and selling soap with the same words and the phrases that they use. That way we can get behind something that is clearly unconstitutional.
Well, if anyone wants to see this written out, actually, I think it's Edward Bernays wrote a book, Propaganda, about exactly this kind of psychological control. Jason, please do talk to my guys, who are the producers. Send me anything you got on this because I want to dive into it. I want to make sure that, you know, I'm giving folks my best. I said folks. I'm going to get a little jarred. No folks. Folks is banned. Anyway, Jason, please give me all the stuff you can. Call back this week, and we'll have an in-depth discussion about what's really going on in Syria. Thank you very much for calling in, buddy. Always good to hear from you. And I will not say folks again. I apologize for that. Folks is the new word that I can't. It's not four letters. Yeah, no, it's not. I don't want to get my numbers wrong here. All right, we got Ovik Roy, who is going to join us now. He is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He's an opinion editor at Forbes. He's a guy who knows Obamacare backwards and forwards. Also an MD, by the way, if you weren't super impressed already. Now you're super duper impressed. This guy really knows his stuff. He's a friend of ours from Real News on the Blaze TV. Ovik, thank you for calling in.
Hey, Buck, how are you? And I really do wholeheartedly support your banning of the word folks.
Thank you, right? You can't. I mean, Obama has ruined it. He's also ruined, let me be clear, these are some of the nastiest after effects of this administration, some of the most disappointing things. I can't say folks. I can't say let me be clear. I can't even say period. Now I have to say full stop.
Say, let me be clear. It just has to, you have to be ironic.
Or lying. Yeah, I could be like, let me be clear. I've never seen that before in my life. I don't know where that came from, officer. So, Ovik, I sent you this. I wanted you to explain what's going on here because there was a Drudge header over the weekend on how Republicans have sort of gotten involved in their first fix. I see the AP headline: at the prodding of business organizations, House Republicans quietly secured a recent change in President Barack Obama's health law to expand coverage choices, a striking, one-of-a-kind departure from dozens of high-decibel attempts to repeal or dismember it. Are we getting drawn? First of all, what was this thing about? And are we getting drawn into, are conservatives, are Republicans getting drawn into playing the let's make a deal game over Obamacare when we should be picking out where Obamacare is going to be, finished and buried?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. First of all, you know, I'm personally of the view that it's very unlikely that Obamacare ever gets repealed. I thought that the 2012 election was our shot to do that. Once you've got people enrolling, and yes, the White House is exaggerating the numbers, but whatever the number ends up being by 2017, it's going to be big enough that repealing Obamacare is going to be politically hard. So I think we, in general, as a movement, have to start thinking about that. And though we still want to push for repeal, we have to think about, are there other ways to achieve our objectives? Because you know, if you don't have a plan B and it's repeal or nothing, then the alternative is pretty problematic, right? So, and there are opportunities, there are ways to move the ball forward in our direction without necessarily repealing Obamacare. Because the thing is, Obamacare is not the only aspect of big government when it comes to healthcare. There's a whole panoply, starting with Medicare and Medicaid. There's a lot to do. So I need to give you that preface of,
right,
before we talk about the things that are going on.
Okay.
Here. So then, in terms of what it is specifically that House Republicans were talking about this particular last weekend, was there was this provision that says, well, for small employers who are offering coverage, the cap on what the deductibles could be, they sort of tweaked that a little bit. It's a fairly technical change, so the question is, can Republicans or should Republicans try to make minor, small technical changes to the law in order to protect people from harm short of full repeal? And it's I think you can see both sides of it, right? Because if you say, no, we want this thing to be a complete disaster, the more, it's kind of a Leninist idea, right? The more of a disaster it becomes, then the more the prospects of repeal go up. Yeah, I guess that's true, but in the meantime, real Americans are going to be seriously harmed by this law. So you do want to try to do certain things if you can to try to protect people from that harm. So it's a tricky question, actually, whether you put the actual harm that people are enduring first, or do you put this longer term strategy of the law being such a disaster, let's not help the Democrats preventing that disaster from happening.
What are the kinds of things that Republicans could do right, or not right now, but from now going forward into the midterms, that would show a willingness to try to help the American people without abandoning the basic idea that this law should have been ruled unconstitutional, should never have been put into place, should never have been passed by the Congress, is being violated at every turn for political purposes by the Obama administration? What are the kind of things they can do that don't essentially undermine all the rest of those parts of the argument? I mean, do you see some things you say, look, Republicans have got to do this, and they can turn around and tell everybody, we don't want to have to do this, but we don't want you guys to all lose your health insurance. What are the things that you think will happen?
Yeah, that's a perfect question, Buck, and I'm glad you asked that. So the thing is, there are a lot of things that Republicans can support, parts of Obamacare that they could vote to repeal or vote to change, that the White House and Democrats will never support because they're so ideologically committed to those aspects of Obamacare. What are those aspects of Obamacare? The aspects of Obamacare that consolidate Washington federal centralized control of how health insurance is designed and delivered. And so there are a number of things around this law. For example, the fact that Obamacare for the first time centralizes the federal level how insurance plans can be designed. It used to be that was regulated at the state level. It still can be regulated at the state level, but Obamacare creates this massive additional federal layer of regulation that all insurance plans across the country have to meet a certain federal standard. And that's what drives up their costs, because as you imagine with anything else in life, you regulate the way it's designed, you basically are forcing those insurance plans to be a lot more expensive. So it would be very easy for Republicans to pass a bill saying, we want to deregulate the Obamacare exchanges so that states now have the authority to regulate their insurance plans how they want, but the federal government is not going to impose its own set of regulations on top of that. They could propose that. The Democrats would never support it because the Democrats support federalization of all these regulations. So that's a way to support something that would say, look, we're on the side of consumers, we're on the side of actually driving the cost of your insurance down, and it's Democrats who are opposing that.
But even still, Ovik, it sounds like there's – now, Democrats oppose it. It means it might not happen, so at least they can't say that Republicans have no ideas. But you do – of course, you understand, and we can't sit here without acknowledging that there's the possibility of making this thing better such that then people don't really necessarily feel the same urge to even try to repeal it down the line if you had the scenario of a Republican-controlled Senate and a Republican in the White House in 2016 – if this thing starts to work at the state level, if it starts to feel like it's more manageable, well, then it becomes really there are many ways that this actually becomes hard to remove. I guess that's kind of what you're saying when you point out that getting rid of this thing entirely may not even be feasible. But is that does that mean that they should stop having these votes where they talk about repeal and they should stop? I just wonder what the better politics are here. I feel like you're talking about it from the perspective of a practitioner, somebody who's like, look, this is how this thing works. These are the biggest problems. These are the ways to make it better. But from a pure politics perspective, is it better to just say, you know what, we can't really do much with this and we just need to get rid of the whole thing until at least we're all in power and then we can figure out what's going on? I mean, how do you – I know you're a healthcare guy. You're not necessarily a guy who's –
No, you're asking a lot of questions there. So let me try to break
it
down.
Go for it. Take them down as you see fit, sir.
Yeah. So there's a couple of points. One, Republicans are never going to have the credibility to enact reforms of their own, nor have a mandate to enact reforms of their own unless they actually have a constructive policy of how to make the healthcare system better, which of course involves reducing and limiting the role of government in messing up the healthcare system. But they actually have to have an approach. They have to be able to explain to people the reason why Obamacare is bad. Look, people like us and the people who listen to your show already understand that Obamacare is bad. That's not the point. The point is, how do we convince the people who voted for Obama, the people who are not ideological, the people who don't care about the things that we care about, how do we convince them to support Republican and conservative approaches to health reform, right? So for them, the issue of, you know, big government and the Constitution and things like that are less important. What matters to those people is the basic pocketbook issue of, is my health insurance going to be more expensive or less? Are my taxes going to go up or are they going to go down? How am I going to be affected by this law? That's what they want to know. So what you have to do as a Republican is you have to build credibility with those voters. Because right now, for all of Obamacare's unpopularity, if you ask voters this question, who do you trust more on health care issues, Democrats or Republicans? Voters actually still trust Democrats more. Despite the fact that Obamacare is such a mess, they still support – they think they trust Democrats more. So Republicans have to build their credibility. That's point number one. Point number two, how do you build your credibility? You actually have to have a constructive approach. You can't stand there in front of the American people and say, yeah, my agenda is to actually mess up your health care more because I think that will make you more trusting of my point of view. That's generally a pretty tricky political strategy, right? So you have to actually have a credible approach and say, look, here's what I would do if I were in power. I would do A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Whether that involves repealing Obamacare or not, here are the things here is what the vision of a free market healthcare system would look like. And to the degree you can establish that, then you can go and say to people, here's what I want to change about Obamacare, here's why I want to repeal Obamacare, and by the way, Medicare and Medicaid and all these other things are also massively distorting the system actually much more than Obamacare. So Obamacare, let's not forget, half of Obamacare's coverage expansion comes from massively expanding Medicaid, right? So you want to talk about this whole thing around single payer and whether Obamacare is secretly a route to single payer? Medicaid is a single payer program. Obamacare expands Medicaid, right? And so a key part of what we have to talk about is how to actually take the Medicaid program and completely change it so that it actually offers better health care and less spending and more efficiency and more freedom than it does today. And, you know, again, you can't just – if we only focus on making the system worse and letting it fall apart, we're never going to have that credibility to go before voters and say what we want to do.
Yeah, well, there you have it, guys. You have Ovik Roy making rationed and reasonable arguments on the one side. On the other side, you're going to have Democrats saying Republicans hate poor people and don't want them to have health care. So I guess the American people in a few months' time will be choosing. Ovik, again, thank you very much. From the Manhattan Institute, also the opinion editor at Forbes.com. Expert on healthcare policy, friend of the show. Thank you very much for calling in, buddy. Good to talk to you.
Sure thing, Buck.
Guys, we got to go to a break here. When we come back, why don't we hear from you? 888-900-3393, or if I think of something funny, we'll do that. So we'll see. Back in a minute.
888-900-3393.
Here on the Buck Saxon Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Buck Sexton Show. Speak your mind. 888-900-3393.
You just heard from Ovick Roy, a healthcare policy expert, one of the best ones in the game, from what I can tell, from what I know. He explained to you all the ins and outs of this. Yeah, it's massively complicated. I do think that there's a place for just continuing for to push for repeal, although there are risks, even if repeal could be achieved. Make no mistake about it. That would give essentially the Democrats the out of saying that everything is now the fault of Republicans. Any dislocations and all of the, just remember how on board, how in the tank the media was for Obamacare from the start. If you were to pull this thing away, they would forget all about the website problems and the premium raises and the unconstitutional, lawless fixes that were just sort of thrown in there by the executive branch. They would forget all of that. And it would turn into conservatives don't want people to have health care. And as stupid as that narrative is when you break it down, unfortunately, it has resonance in a political context. But you can listen to me, you can listen to Ovick, listen to so many others, or turn to the unquestioned and unquestionable expertise on healthcare policy of we have to pass the bill to see what's in it, Nancy Pelosi. Listen to this.
You think it's integral. You think the employer mandate
all
is integral and
yes.
will and has to stay.
Yeah, and this is an initiative that has strong pillars in it that relate to each other.
But it's
to
initiative.
Put a period on it, you cannot see supporting anything that would remove the business mandate.
No.
I don't know. We're focusing on that. One person says one thing. Seven million people signed up. The Congress of the United States, which wrote the bill, the members, which are proud of what they have done, are happy to not run away from what we have done, very proud of what we have accomplished.
They're very proud of what we've accomplished.
No, they're not. They're all running away from it now because they realize what they have unleashed on the American people. Some of them are going to try to hedge their bets and pretend that they think this is a good idea and that somehow this is all going to work in the end. But I have to tell you, it's going to be very interesting to see who now will stand with the American people and be honest about Obamacare on the Democrat side of the issue and who just do anything, absolutely anything, in order to keep their position in elected government, whether it's to win it in the first place or to maintain it if they're in fact an incumbent. I mean, Pelosi is saying that they can never remove the business mandate, because that would be an admission that the underlying architecture of the entire program has failed, is inherently flawed. They've kicked it into the future. Why? Because if they actually implemented it on schedule, people would realize what's going on. People would get fired. They would lose their jobs. They would no longer have the protections that they think that they have under this law. And all of a sudden, the reality of it would hit home very hard. But by the same token, they can kick it into the future, but they can't say it's sort of like our national debt. You can keep pushing it into the future, but you can't renounce it, right? Because then the team is up. And then the game is up, rather. And then it's all over. All of a sudden, you're in a position where people won't buy your bonds, won't loan you money. Well, if the absolutely essential parts of the law that are needed for it to actually hold together and to do the things that it says it's going to do, if there was an admission that those things were not in fact possible, if they admitted that now, then we would recognize that this thing is a failed venture in a wholesale. Whereas by pushing it into the future, you can always have this debate, this discussion about what needs to be done, what will be done, how we can change it, how we can make it better. And so this is now going to be a part of all of it. But you'll see, this is very important now. The different ways that the left-wing narrative separates itself from reality and becomes just a question of posturing and propaganda in the media. The CIA issue is about left-wing, or is about left-wingers who were anti-Cheney, anti-Halliburton, anti-waterboarding and all the rest of this, trying to make it seem like what's coming up here is a referendum between the Bush administration and the Obama administration. The Koch brothers ad, that's an attempt to make it seem like Mitt Romney has been replaced. The plutocrat Mitt Romney, who's only worth a couple of hundred million, not a hundred billion like the Kochs. But he's been replaced with the Koch brothers as the evil schemer behind the scenes trying to take away your health care, trying to shut down plants for no reason. And now with Obamacare, it's just they want people to have health care. They want to fix things. They want to make it better. And Republicans just don't want people to have health care because they're mean. Childish narratives, but unfortunately, they can be very powerful in politics. All right, we're going to do a buck brief after the break. I'm going to have my friend Stephen Yates joining. We're going to talk about Ukraine, Afghanistan, what's going on in the rest of the world, and then we're going to bring it home with some more domestic tidbits. Team Buck, I got a lot more. Don't go anywhere.
Buck Sexton, The Blaze Radio Network.